It's hard to go against the grain, especially when that grain involves a lot of money and free Broadway tickets. But that's how the Carlett Report got started. We're going to tell you the story today. Welcome to the Carlett Psychiatry Podcast, a CME publication, keeping psychiatry honest since 2003.
I'm Chris Aiken, the editor-in-chief of the Carlett Psychiatry Report.
And I'm Kelly Newsom, a Psych NP student and a dedicated reader of every issue.
Last month, we brought you an update on some of the new strategies that the pharmaceutical industry has used to promote their medications, including giving lap dances to doctors and direct cash payments to get them to prescribe more of their product. And while most of us would not accept corruption on that blatant a level, it left me wondering where we do draw our own lines with the industry. So today I'm going to interview Daniel Danny Carlett, who founded the Carlett Report in 2003 after some experiences on the educational side of the pharmaceutical industry that forced him to draw his own lines with their influence. Danny, tell us how you first got involved as a speaker for the pharmaceutical industry.
I was doing basic private practice psychiatry at the time, and it was actually the spring of 2001. I was in my office in beautiful, picturesque downtown Newburyport, Massachusetts, and one of the district managers from Wyeth Pharmaceuticals came into my office, and I knew him from other encounters that I had had. He made a proposition to me, which was, and he couched it in flattery. He said, "Dr. Carlett, you know, you're a well-known psychiatrist in the publishing world," because I had published a textbook on psychiatric interviewing that he knew about. "I was wondering if you'd like to be one of our speakers for Effexor." And he bounced around some figures, like $500 to $1,000 per talk. And I was pretty intrigued. I ended up doing it. And process that led me to actually begin giving the talks, and then, you know, the whole process of why I decided to stop them was very instrumental in leading me to start the Carlett Report.
So you went into it with a pretty open mind. How did that change as you went through the process?
So, I mean, you have to understand that at that time, we weren't as sophisticated about understanding all the drug marketing tactics. So I certainly didn't understand what the whole system was at the time. So I found out, and that was what was very enlightening to me. So for example, what I was really hired to do was to give lunch and learn talks. So I would go with the drug reps to either primary care offices or psychiatry offices, and I would bring either slides or just a handout, and I would talk about antidepressants.
So the drug reps came with, and what were some of the strategies that you saw them use?
The interesting thing is that the drug reps would sort of pave the way for these talks because they knew exactly how many prescriptions these doctors were prescribing based on looking at pharmacy prescription data mining records. So they would talk about things like deciles, which I don't know if you had ever heard about that, but I certainly hadn't. And so, you know, the higher the decile from 1 to 10, the more prescriptions that doctor was writing. And then they would also be able to get it down to a more fine-grained level. And, you know, they would say, "Dr. Smith is only prescribing 6% of his antidepressants or Effexor. So when we go in, you know, he's going to be challenging. And, you know, we really need to push him with the data on Effexor and get him to prescribe more of it." So there was that, which I didn't really know about, and I think still happens to some degree.
Were there other direct or indirect pressures you felt as a speaker?
There was an expectation, maybe an unspoken expectation, that I was going to play up the advantages of Effexor, and I was going to play down the disadvantages. And that was kind of based on an initial key opinion leader meeting that I was invited to in New York at the Millennial Hotel. I remember, you know, arriving at the hotel, getting some tickets to a Broadway show, getting an envelope with $750 in it, being treated like a king. My wife was there. And I, along with, you know, another 100 or so psychiatrists, were listening to lectures from really, really top people like Norm Sussman, Michael Thace, who were also being paid by the company to give talks. But they were giving talks to the people who were going to be giving talks to other doctors. So they were the bigger honchos. And so we learned how to use our slide decks based on those talks. And I'm not going to say that we were taught to lie or even taught to purposefully deceive anyone, but there is always more than one way to look at data.
What were some of the examples of that with Effexor?
You know, an example that comes to mind is the data on hypertension. So, you know, Effexor, I mean, it's a great drug. I certainly prescribe it. We all know that it can cause hypertension, certainly more so than SSRIs, more so than other SNRIs. And I think the data that I remember was something like 1% of people on placebo had hypertension and 2% of people on Effexor had hypertension. And the way that it was described was that that's only a 1% difference. But, you know, another way to describe that is it's a 50% increase, or actually 100% increase in the rate of hypertension. So that was the kind of thing that we were taught to do. And so when I would give my talks, I would sort of frame the data in that way, which was just a way of encouraging the doctors to think about prescribing Effexor as a first line rather than a second or third line drug.
I think that kind of bias in how data is presented still goes on today. A couple of months ago, the genetic testing company AssureRx started passing around pamphlets to physicians about a new study they had released. And this surprised me because the study was actually negative. But the way they presented the data in the pamphlet was they put the secondary outcome measures on the cover, and those were barely positive. And then they took the primary outcome measures, which were clearly negative, and hid them inside the pamphlet. So reading through the pamphlet, it looked like pharmacogenetic testing is making a big difference for people with depression when the difference is actually barely detectable. And we covered that story a couple months ago in the Carlett Report. Our listeners can find that online. Back to your work with Wyeth, did you sign up to be a speaker for Effexor because you had a particularly favorable view of the drug to begin with?
I had an open mind. I, like many others, had read some of the research showing that the remission rates on Effexor were 45% as opposed to 35% on SSRIs and compared to 25% on placebo. I think anybody would have been interested in that. We're always looking for something more effective. So yes, I was prescribing it. I was interested in learning more. But I think over time, we have found that those initial numbers were probably overly optimistic, and the number needed to treat to actually get an extra benefit from Effexor over an SSRI is something in the range of 10, which is not particularly impressive. And the other thing that struck me, of course, was that suddenly everybody was talking about remission, whereas before that, everybody was talking about response rates. And it was clear that if you looked at remission rates, that the separation between Effexor and some of the other drugs was more impressive appearing than if you talked about response rates. So again, many ways to look at the data, and it really depends on what your intention is. If your intention is to market the drug and make money, you're going to look at it one way. If your intention is just to choose, you know, the right medication for the right patient, you're going to look at it probably in a more objective way.
When you did this work, did you get to interact with other doctors who were also training to be speakers?
I did. And interestingly, a lot of what I found out is that many doctors that were at that meeting were also working for several other pharmaceutical companies, including the company that was marketing Neurontin for bipolar disorder, which was an off-label indication. And that company later had to settle with the attorneys general for a large amount of money due to illegal off-label marketing. So I would talk to, and I would sort of trade experiences with other doctors who were doing other talks, either for Effexor or for other agents.
And did you get a sense that any of your colleagues had some growing skepticism or cognitive dissonance as they went through the process?
I didn't. And I'm really surprised. I was certainly getting a good, healthy dose of cognitive dissonance as I was giving my talks over that year of living dangerously, unethically, as I sometimes call it. But I didn't really hear that same sense from others, and I'm not really sure why. There haven't been many others who used to be promotional speakers who quit the game and then talked about it. And that may be because it's kind of an embarrassing admission to say that you feel like you were behaving in an unethical manner.
I think we've all heard various justifications from doctors who do these talks. One of the most common ones is that they speak for many different companies, so wouldn't really be capable of bias because they're pulled in many directions.
Right. You know, I'm not able to be in people's minds, and I don't believe that I should be sitting on a moral high ground and judging people. So when doctors tell me these things, I'm just kind of, I'm going to trust them. If they say that they believe they're being unbiased and that they're relying on the medical evidence, then I assume they believe that, and maybe it's true.
Now, I have to ask you this, Danny, because a couple years after you left the industry, you wrote a piece for the New York Times called Dr. Drug Rep. Did you go into that experience as a speaker in any way to be an investigative journalist and get an inside view to better understand the inner workings of the system?
No.
As you went through that year, what were some of the pivotal moments that changed how you thought about what you were doing?
My job was to accompany reps who were bringing sandwiches to doctors, and I was there to give medical education. And I would steer them kind of in the direction of learning good things about Effexor, learning about its efficacy, learning about side effects in such a way that they would not be too worried about things like hypertension or discontinuation symptoms. What ended up happening is that it was a gradual process for me in my mind of beginning to feel sleazier and sleazier over that year of giving these talks. And if there was one situation or event that really sealed the deal for me, it was when I gave a talk for a group of pretty sophisticated psychiatrists who were familiar with the data. And I was not able to tweak or to selectively present it because they pretty much knew about it. And one of them called me on it. He asked me a question. Well, you know, I hear what you're saying about hypertension not being as big a concern as we thought, but that really hasn't been my clinical experience, he said. And I went home thinking, you know, I really can't be doing this anymore. Ultimately, the slippery slope was just too slippery, and the allure of those big fat checks was too much for me to believe that I could be completely honest in my talks. And then the next talk I gave was for, I think, just a primary care doctor. And I remembered being much more frank about some of my doubts about the actual benefit of Effexor over SSRIs, doubts based on the length of the clinical trials, that they were fairly short. And my suspicion was that if they had been longer, there wouldn't have been as much of a separation between Effexor and SSRIs and things like that. And then the next day, that original very nice district manager from Wyeth who had recruited me came in and said, you know, Dr. Carlat, the reps at your last talk told me that you didn't seem as enthusiastic about our product as you had been. Have you been sick? And I guess I think I was sniffling. Maybe I had allergies, but I hadn't been sick, and that wasn't the reason that I changed my tune. And, you know, I was very nice. I said, you know, I just don't think I can, you know, do these talks anymore. You know, thanks very much.
So I guess you were getting sick, but it was a different kind of sickness you had.
Exactly. Yeah, it was kind of more of a gastrointestinal feeling. I just can't do that anymore.
Well, tell us how that led to the founding of the Carlat Report.
During that time when I was having second thoughts about the talks I was giving, I was already thinking about, well, so much of medical education is funded either directly or indirectly by drug companies, and there just isn't very much out there that's an alternative. And I thought, well, maybe I should create that alternative. So I sat down. I remember being on vacation with my family in Nantucket, sat down outside with a notepad and started just writing down thoughts. And the first things that came to me were, you know, I should just start with an issue looking at, is there really an advantage of Effexor over SSRIs? Is there an advantage of Lexapro over Celexa? Is there an advantage of Paxil CR over regular Paxil? These were all products that had been recently approved, you know, and they all seemed basically like kind of Me Too products. And nobody had been calling the companies out on their hype. So my very first issue was early 2003, and it was on antidepressants. And I just went through all of the evidence, both pro and con, these newer medications.
And you made a pretty bold business decision there, Danny, to start this whole report without any funding from advertisers or the industry. How did you get it started?
It was really started on a shoestring. I got a mailing list of all 2,000 to 3,000 psychiatrists that I think were members of the Massachusetts Psychiatric Society at the time. And there was, you know, a surprising response. People loved it and people started subscribing.
Did the industry take any interest in what you were doing?
In general, I would say that they've taken kind of a hands-off approach. However, sometime, I'm going to say 2004, 2005, I did have a little tussle with Eli Lilly because I had published critical articles about Zyprexa and Cymbalta. And by critical, acknowledging that they were effective drugs, but also talking about some of their side effects. The CME provider that was accrediting my CME was contacted by an attorney at Eli Lilly asking pointed questions and being kind of intimidating, as lawyers can be. And before they even did an investigation, and I'm talking about the CME provider, they just dropped me and they said, you know, you can't provide any CME. We have reason to believe that your CME is biased. And that was a scary time for me because I had just recently started the business and I was worried. Luckily, later on, I was able to get my own accreditation. So now Carlyle Publishing is accredited by the ACCME.
Okay, that might be one of the most shocking things I've heard yet. When we go to CME talks, the audience is supposed to rate the speaker based on whether they saw any evidence of industry or other bias in the talk. But here you're saying that the pharmaceutical industry was actually using that same avenue to rate you on whether they thought you were biased against their drug and going through your CME provider, who's supposed to be the gatekeeper against all this, to try to censor that material, which is exactly what the CME provider did.
Right. Well, you know, the CME industry is supposed to be unbiased and it's supposed to provide unbiased and objective medical education, but it's an issue of money. At one point, about 50% of all the money going into CME programs was supplied by the drug industry. And when pharmaceutical companies fund CME programs, they're not supposed to, according to ACCME regulations, be able to influence the content of the courses or of the articles. But there are ways that they are able to influence it. And everybody knows that this happens. And, you know, the way that it happens is that they will provide a supposedly hands-off grant of, you know, several thousand, $50,000, $100,000 to a company. And the company then will hire a doctor or an academic to create the program. But everybody knows what company is funding the program. And it doesn't take too much imagination to realize that if you don't end up with a program that's fairly positive about a certain drug, you're not going to get funding next year for another CME course. So even though they have to sign paperwork saying that they have processes in place to prevent these things from happening, in the real world, bias creeps in.
Now, on the other hand, the system is not entirely broken, and there have been some positive changes in the last decade. We gave a few examples in a podcast we did last month called Cash, Guns, and a Lap Dancing Drug Rep, a few examples in which the government had shut down the industry for trying to promote inappropriate off-label use of their medications, such as Risperdal for dementia or Trileptal for bipolar disorder. But at the same time, I realized that there doesn't seem to be any move to get these companies to do public retractions of the message. So in the case of Trileptal, which we're going to be covering in a future issue, the word got out through these talks that Trileptal was appropriate for bipolar disorder, despite a lot of negative studies in the condition. And while it's good that that kind of promotion was shut down, at that point the genie is already out of the bottle, and it doesn't seem like the industry has been required to give talks retracting the message and undoing the damage.
One of the big cases having to do with off-label prescribing was actually Neurontin for bipolar disorder and some other neurologic conditions for which it didn't have approval. And a whistleblower suit back in 2002, 2003, there was a whistleblower suit brought against Warner Lambert, which was producing Neurontin. They weren't found guilty, but they settled the case for $430 million. And what happened with that money is that some portion of that money was reserved by the attorneys general of several states to create programs to educate doctors about pharmaceutical marketing. And not many people know about these programs, but it's out there and you can find some articles that were written based on that grant program that are unbiased. That was a positive way to try to remedy a wrong.
And in closing, do you have any advice for our listeners as they manage their own relationships with the pharmaceutical industry and with drug reps today?
I think that you have to decide for yourself how you're going to handle your relationship with pharmaceutical companies. For myself, I have had a no drug rep policy and a no sample policy. I do that because I don't think that the drug reps really can provide objective information. And I don't think that samples really do anything other than encourage us to end up prescribing, you know, more expensive brand name drugs instead of generic drugs that might be just as effective. People should, you know, rather than getting CME on websites or conferences that are funded either directly or indirectly by the pharmaceutical industry, I think people should spend maybe a little bit more money. It's all tax deductible, and purchase, you know, more sources of CME that are not biased. I mean, obviously, I'm partial to the Carlat report, but there's many, many others now that are really good and that don't have any drug company funding. So those are the main, you know, suggestions that I would make.
Thank you, Dr. Carlat. That's all for this episode. You can send us your questions at asktheeditor@thecarlatreport.com. And if you'd like to read more of our issues, we have a special offer for our podcast listeners with the promo code PODCAST. You can get $30 off your first year's subscription.
And this subscription includes the print edition delivered to your mailbox and full access to all the articles on the website. Monthly CME credits to maintain licensure, as well as an option for self-assessment credits toward your board certificate.
The Carlat Report is one of few CME publications that depends entirely on subscriber support. We accept no advertising or Broadway tickets, which helps us bring you unbiased information you can trust.